At 6 years old, most children blow out birthday candles wishing for toys or puppies. Jeanette McCurdy wished only that her mother would survive another year. This wasn't typical childhood worry. It was the foundation of a relationship built on fear, manipulation, and the suffocating weight of unfulfilled dreams. Jeanette's mother, Deborah, had stage 4 breast cancer, and this diagnosis became the emotional currency that bought complete control over her daughter's life. Every decision, every boundary violation, every stolen moment of childhood was justified by the unspoken threat. Your mother might die, and this could be your fault. Deborah didn't just want Jeanette to act, she needed it. You want to be mommy's little actress? Wasn't really a question. It was a command wrapped in maternal desperation. And Jeanette, terrified of disappointing a potentially dying mother, knew there was only one acceptable answer. The irony cuts deep. While Deborah framed acting as giving Jeanette the life she never had, she was actually stealing the childhood her daughter did have. What began as a mother's vicarious ambition metastasized into something far darker. A relationship where love became indistinguishable from control, and survival meant erasing yourself completely. Their home embodied the family's dysfunction. Mountains of clutter rendered bedrooms unusable, forcing everyone to sleep on gymnastics mats in the living room. Church became Jeanette's precious 3-hour weekly escape. Behind closed doors, violations intensified. Well into her teenage years, Deborah insisted on showering Jeanette, performing invasive breast and front butt exams under the guise of cancer prevention. These medically unjustified examinations stole Jeanette's bodily autonomy. During these moments, Jeanette mentally escaped to Disneyland, a dissociation that would later fuel her eating disorders. When brother Scotty asked to shower himself, Deborah's manipulative sobbing and accusations of abandonment ensured he never asked again. She had weaponized vulnerability so effectively that her children policed themselves. Control extended into Jeanette's identity. Her appearance required constant maintenance, highlights, mascara, whitening strips. Each compliment came packaged with criticism, requiring store-bought solutions. When Jeanette couldn't audition for a film because she lacked ethereal beauty, Deborah was devastated. The message? Jeanette's worth was measured entirely by her marketability. Landing iCarly should have been the triumph that finally satisfied Deborah's hunger for success, but abundance brought tighter chains. Jeanette's dressing room filled with gift baskets, yet her mother still monitored every bite, splitting a single cantaloupe skewer as though plenty itself was dangerous. Working alongside Miranda Cosgrove, Jeanette glimpsed independence, drinking Coke, owning a sidekick, cursing freely. Though Deborah warned against friendship because she doesn't believe in God, their bond grew through secret AIM conversations Jeanette carefully hid. Fame stole intimate moments before Jeanette could claim them. Her first kiss happened on camera after 7 takes, leaving her frozen while the creator yelled directions. When she got her first period on set and word spread, the humiliation drove her back to anorexia. If she couldn't control her changing body or public life, she would control her weight. The creator's behavior added another layer of exploitation. Unwanted shoulder massages, pressure to drink alcohol, uncomfortable power dynamics. When Nickelodeon later offered $300,000 as hush money to never speak publicly about her experiences, Jeanette refused immediately. Some silences cost more than they're worth. At 18, Jeanette fled to Nashville for country music. Freedom meant rebellion, gorging on burgers, fries, cookies, candy. Each binge was both liberation and punishment, her body the battlefield for autonomy she couldn't claim. Her first relationship with Lucas, her 27-year-old band leader, compressed denied teenage experiences into uncomfortable age gaps. Returning from tour, Deborah's cutting assessment, "Net, what happened? You're getting chunky," reminded her that maternal love remained conditional. As Deborah's cancer returned, their roles reversed. Deborah's suggestion about staying over at Jeanette's apartment evolved into permanent occupation, literally claiming her bed and clinging to her nightly. Paparazzi photos of Jeanette with Joe unleashed Deborah's vicious assault, emails branding her slut, floozy, liar, monster. She weaponized family relationships and blamed Jeanette's betrayal for her cancer's return. Yet Jeanette's conditioning ran so deep, she desperately begged to explain. This pattern continued until Deborah's dramatic collapse during her birthday celebration, seizing violently beneath Jeanette's giant iCarly billboard, her manufactured public smile looming above her dying mother, a perfect metaphor for the artifice defining everything between them. After her mother's death, Jeanette faced building an identity beyond mommy's little actress. Within days, she fell into bulimia, gorging before purging, feeling victorious watching her food come up. This is the start of something good, she thought, unable to see how this disorder would dominate the next phase of her life. On Sam and Cat, her resentment toward Ariana Grande crystallized, not because Ariana was unkind, but because she represented everything Jeanette lacked. Ariana missed work for her music career, while Jeanette remained the reliable, good sport. Her eating disorder worsened, throat bleeding daily, teeth softening, cavities developing, yet producers and agents praised her body. Then another revelation. Mark, Dad, wasn't her biological father. Even when dying, Deborah never told her this fundamental truth. Recovery began reluctantly after boyfriend Steven discovered vomit residue and issued an ultimatum. When her first therapist suggested her mother had been abusive, Jeanette fled. A second attempt with Jeff, an eating disorder specialist, proved transformative. His methodical approach included throwing out diet foods, tracking patterns, normalizing eating. The breakthrough? Shame keeps us stuck, while guilt and frustration help us move forward. Accepting setbacks without spiraling became crucial to recovery. On her 24th birthday, Jeanette threw her scale down the trash chute. When Miranda called about the iCarly reboot, she declined. There are things more important than money, and my mental health and happiness fall under that category. At a fancy party, she chose a chocolate chip cookie, something she never would have allowed herself during anorexia or kept down during bulimia. It had been over a year since she'd purged. The final liberation came at her mother's grave, staring at the headstone crowded with adjectives, brave, kind, loyal, sweet. Jeanette felt angry at how we romanticize the dead. The truth was, her mother was a narcissist who abused her. Yet, she still missed certain things: pep talks, childlike spirit, infectious happiness when it rarely appeared. She knew if Deborah were still alive, she'd likely still be purging, restricting, acting miserably, heading toward public breakdown. Standing up, wiping dirt off her jeans, walking away, Jeanette knew she wouldn't be coming back, to the grave or to the patterns that had defined her life. The title, "I'm Glad My Mom Died," isn't just provocation. It's honest acknowledgement that some relationships are so toxic, their end brings relief. In sharing her story with unflinching honesty, Jeanette offers hope to others trapped in cycles of abuse and people-pleasing. By reclaiming her story, she invites us to consider what narratives we might need to rewrite to finally be free.